Gatha opening sutra. The Dharma incomparably profound and infinitely subtle is rarely encountered even in millions of ages. Now we see it, hear it, receive and maintain it. May we completely realize the Tathagata's true meaning.
So this morning we're going to do a contemporary koan. The talk is in, and maybe I've been sort of somewhat inspired by The Hidden Lamp, which has some contemporary koans. The Tenzo asked Daido Sensei in all earnestness, "How do I let go?" Daido opened his hand and dropped his kutsu and asked the Tenzo, "Do you understand?" The Tenzo hesitated and then responded, "No." Daido dropped the stick again. Once again he asked, "Do you understand?" Visibly confused, the Tenzo shook her head, "No." Daido then asked her, "When you are in the kitchen, how do you put down a spoon?" The Tenzo opened her hand. Unlike most of our koans that are set in the monasteries of Tang Dynasty China, this one took place at Zen Mountain Monastery in Mount Tremper, New York, during the 1980s. Daido Luri, who was a Dharma heir of Maizumi Roshi, who was the person who brought our lineage to North America, was a sensei at that time, although he later became a Roshi. The Tenzo is the monastery's cook, and she was a resident student. Her question was a wonderful one, as it goes deep into the very heart of our Zen practice, because letting go is the essence of Zen practice. What is it that we have to let go of? Simply, we have to let go of everything. When we recite the four great bodhisattva vows, we say, "Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them." That's another way of speaking about this practice of letting go. Our delusions are truly inexhaustible. We cannot reach the end of them in this lifetime. One of the prevalent myths about Zen is that we can reach a state where we are no longer deluded. Delusive thoughts arise constantly, and we must practice letting go many times each day. This ceaseless practice continues endlessly throughout our lives. Many of you know Sheila, who used to practice here. The very first time that I met her in Daisan, I told her that she needed to let go of everything. That night, there was a fire in the cabin she was living in. The cabin burned to the ground, and almost all of her possessions were destroyed. That was certainly a traumatic way to learn about letting go. But life is constantly confronting us with losses, both great and small. No matter how secure we may believe that our lives are, the reality of the Buddha's teaching of impermanence is certain. Nothing is permanent. Our possessions, our relationships, our homes, our jobs, and even our very lives, everything we hold dear must come to an end. Through the practice of letting go, we can learn to stay awake and be able to face and deal with these painful losses when they come, thereby lessening our dukkha, our suffering. So how do we let go? Does Daido's physical metaphor of opening the hand and releasing the stick really answer the Kenzo's question? Perhaps, but I think it's useful to examine the process more closely. we actually begin learning to let go the minute we start breath counting practice. When we realize that we've allowed our thoughts to distract us from the practice of counting, and we refocus our mind, returning to our concentration on our breath, that is letting go. Whatever the thoughts are that have arisen, no matter how important they may seem to us at that moment, we let go. In fact, that very basic first practice is the very same practice that we will continue throughout our lifetime. These days, there's a lot of emphasis on the mindfulness aspect of breath practice. But I feel that from a Zen perspective, it is not the act of paying attention or being present that is important. It is the act of letting go and returning to the breath that really matters. Many beginners become frustrated because they can't concentrate for long. But being distracted doesn't really matter as long as we use that opportunity to let go and refocus on the breath. The goal of Zen practice is not to eliminate our thoughts, it is to loosen our attachment to those thoughts. We are not practicing to have an idle mind. We are practicing to have an open and flexible mind that does not cling to delusions. Later in our practice, we begin koan study, and the koans themselves are the tool for helping us to let go. Typically, as soon as we begin to work on the koan, we attempt to assume it under a preconceived conceptual structure, utilizing our usual cognitive approach to grasp what it is trying to say. However, this will only result in our being told again and again in Daisan that we must go deeper. Sooner or later, if we are to pass, we must relinquish everything we know about the koan so that we can be truly intimate with it. The transformation that Zen practice brings to the core of our being happens slowly, moment by moment. Each time we become aware of a stuck place, a fixed idea, a self-centered conceptualization, we must let go. Sometimes that's easy, but with our firmest and deepest attachments, we may need to repeat the process many, many times. And this is one of the areas where working with a teacher is critical. No matter how sincere our practice is, it is often almost impossible for us to recognize our most closely held attachments for what they are. And even when we finally do see them, we can be extraordinarily reluctant to let them go. Gradually, through this practice of letting go, our self-centered needs and agendas begin to loosen their hold on us. When that happens, our natural compassion can begin to shine through, and we have an opportunity to cultivate it. In the past, I've described this process as turning our skin inside out, allowing all of the things that are outside of us to become the core of our being. Years ago, Steph gave a talk called The Little Way of Zen. Of his many wonderful talks, I think that this was the best. Inspired by utter simplicity, unadorned directness, and profound humility of a Chan teacher, Chao Cho, and a Catholic sister, Saint Therese of Lisieux, Steph's talk brings those elements to the context of contemporary Zen practice. The practice of letting go is absolutely consistent with the little way. In the practice of letting go, there are no great gestures, no magnificent spiritual gymnastics, no astonishing breakthroughs. We just let go over and over. Whether we are sitting zazen, walking in the kinhin line, being with our families, working our jobs, or resting at night, we just repeat and repeat the process. Whatever arises, we just let it go. Over time, if we are able to loosen the grips of our attachments sufficiently, the greatest delusion of them all, the delusion of separation, begins to become less firm, more transparent. We open to the reality of the one body, the fact that this entire universe isn't a collection of separate entities, but rather that there are no boundaries, that everything is an expression of the great whole. Of course, even that realization is something that we must let go of. If we fail to do that, it too becomes a concept, an object that we try to cling to. The same is true for the practice of Zen itself. Gradually, we must come to the place where there is no Zen that exists as a thing, a concept. At that stage, there is just practice, ceaseless practice. In time, though, even practice must disappear. What then? What is left when everything is gone, when there is no thing anywhere that we can cling to? Hotai's response to that question was to plop down in the dirt in the midst of the marketplace, playing with the children, his laughter reverberating across the land. What is your response? The Tenzo asked Daido Sensei in all earnestness, "How do I let go?" Daido opened his hand and dropped his kutsu and asked the Tenzo, "Do you understand?" The Tenzo hesitated and then responded, "No." Daido dropped the stick again. Once again he asked, "Do you understand?" Visibly confused, the Tenzo shook her head, "No." Daido then asked her, "When you're in the kitchen, how do you put down a spoon?" The Tenzo opened her hand.
Yeah, the other day there was a, I don't remember the exact context of it, but there was that, sort of that talking, sort of skirting that idea of the, you know, you're playing basketball and someone throws the ball at you, well, you're right there to receive it, you know, you're right there in the moment. And I came across something recently that was, that's all well and good, but there's another type of being completely immersed in what you're doing, which is doesn't have a whole lot to do with letting go, and it is not the point of Zen, you know, which is being completely sort of absorbed. The caricature of it for me is being, you know, sucked in by a TV program or sucked in by something I'm doing on the computer. So there's nothing but that, and there's a place for that. But
I'm going to take exception to what you just said, Dan, and then I'll let other people speak. I think that's absolutely has something to do with Zen. I think it's absolutely Zen.
Anybody? Well, I suppose, but if I don't hear Lillian calling me, you know, assuming I can hear her, that isn't Zen. I mean, that isn't exactly the point, you know. I mean, we all have our ability to be lost in a thing, and that's okay. I don't know. I think. Being not controlled by emotions, being completely in our emotions, but not being completely driven by emotions. I think this bears on what you're talking about. I mean, about this koan.
So I think that place where we're in touch with the absolute, you know, with the one body, and when body and mind drop away and we're just completely there, right, with whatever we're doing, I think that's something everybody experiences at various points in their life. It's not unique to Zen people. And I think that a lot of times people seek out things that give them that experience because it feels good to be there. It feels, you know, it feels joyful and, it, you know, and we're not beating ourselves up with our suffering. And so we find ways to touch that, whether it's going into nature, whether it's watching a really good movie where you completely lose yourself in it, or reading a good book where you completely lose yourself in it.
Rock climbing,
that's the classic one, right? If you are not 100% there when you're rock climbing, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. And that's where that's why that is so addictive for people, because it puts them there in that state. You don't have a choice but to, you know, be right there when you're rock climbing. I think the problem is that we become dependent on those things to give us that, instead of realizing that that's our true nature, that we have access to it all the time. So we think we need to be having sex or eating chocolate cake or smoking a joint or whatever it is that we think is gonna bring us there. We think we need that, instead of realizing that we carry it around all the time. And I don't know if that's close to what you were saying, Dan, but I think that's how we get that imbalance where we start looking to external things to give us something that we don't actually lack.
Mm. That's good. Yeah, we also have to be careful what we allow to ourselves to be absorbed in. I mean, like you're saying, you know, if it's your work, if you're in your shop and you're working on a project, then being completely absorbed in that project is probably a good thing. Yeah. And therefore, the letting go is about all the other crap. Like, oh, geez, I got all these bills, or I've got, you know what I mean? Da, da, da. No, I got to stay on what I'm doing, right? You know, but if a video game becomes the object of our absorption, is that the same thing? It can be. If it's, I think, you know, but it can also become an addiction. It can also become what Jamie's describing. And, you know, it can become an end in itself. Which can be kind of a slippery slope where we can lose sight of.
You know, that rock climbing thing is it's a useful thing in the sense that you've got to be completely in contact with the rock. You've got to be completely there. But if you miss the fact that there's something going on over your head because you're completely here, the focus is, you know, you blew it. You know, the rock fell on your head because you didn't saw it. You know, I don't know whether it's a small point. You know, or only in the sense that I think total absorption is completely part of our lives and completely how we function. But it's that attachment to that. Okay, I think that's nailed it. Okay.
In a sense, we are all rock climbing, and we're all going to fall off, right? I mean, that's what the strawberry story is talking about, right? I mean, we are all suspended above the chasm. We all have the tigers waiting for us. And so, and then in that moment, ha, there's the strawberry. Should we also be thinking, oh God, a bird might crap on my head right now while I'm tasting the strawberry? Or do we just take that possibility for what it is and not worry about all the other possibilities?
I think the difference between that mindfulness, that the issue with mindfulness is the sense that we have to, there's something behind that mindfulness that we're still carrying it all. We're not letting it all go. Could that be it? You know, in other words, it's still a kind of a managing thing, whereas the letting go is you got to let go of even managing.
That definitely. Mindfulness is a perspective, right? Mindfulness, and in mindfulness, somebody is watching. Somebody is being mindful. There's an I in that sentence. I am being mindful. I am paying attention, right? And that, to me, is distinctively different from the state of absorption that Jamie talked about. You know what I mean? The kind of being completely present is not being aware that we are completely present. It's not, you know, that immediately creates separation. There's immediately self and other when I say, ha, I'm being mindful, I'm being present, I'm being absorbed, right? You know, if in the flexible mind that I'm trying to pointing to here, then in one moment we're focused on the TV, and in the next moment we're focused on Lil's voice, and in the next, you know what I mean? It's kind of, you know, if I'm just being, you know, if I'm setting mindfulness as a target, then everything that's not the exact thing that I'm concentrating on is somehow extraneous. But if my mind is simply there, I am there, then whatever it is, boom, just responds, just respond. Da-da-da. Someone calls my name. Ha. You know, and then back to the, whatever it is, the TV show, the, you know, there isn't sort of a hierarchy set up that says, you know, following the breath, that's good. Following the TV, that's bad. You know, that sort of, we ennoble the thing. I mean, Jamie and I just talked, she just, in her Daisana, I'm sure she won't mind me saying this, you know, she talked about the ennobling of silence. We talk about silence as if it's this special, or it can, becomes this special, noble thing, as opposed to, huh, it's just quiet, you know? It's just quiet. The next moment the crow calls, and the next moment the phone rings. No hierarchy.
In your talk, you know, you're talking over and over again about the idea of Zazen, and you're letting go, and the important thing is letting go. And I maybe haven't read enough Zen, but I've never seen that expressed like so clearly before, you know, before your talk, actually. I found that really helpful. Especially because I'm kind of ADD, you know, I can imagine like just never being able to, you know, really have that kind of quiet, you know, silent mind that is sort of an image that people have of what Zen is. And, but it seems like there may also be like different strains of Zen, like the monastery-based Zen, where for years and years you're just sitting in the monastery. Maybe you eventually do get a very quiet mind, you know. I was reading something about a year ago by some Japanese Zen master. In Japan, apparently, they have something like character building through Zen. And this is actually like an article called Character Building Through Zen. And Japanese businessmen go to a retreat for a month or two of character building through Zen. And, you know, so the guy is talking, in this article, he's talking about, well, you sit there and you count your breaths to 100, and when you get to a certain, when you get to the point you can count to 100 without any interfering thoughts, then you can go to counting to just 10. And when you've done that, and there's even, I don't know, when it was even less than no interfering thoughts, then you can try Shikantaza. And the idea is somehow you come out of this training with a mind that is like really disciplined or something, in some way that you just don't even have these interfering thoughts, you know, is what he seems to be saying. And it does seem like it could maybe happen if you're in a monastery for 20 years, you know.
Well, I don't know. I mean, since I've never been in a monastery for 10 years. I guess I would sort of just ask the question, so what? Is that good? I don't think I'd hire the businessman who has no thoughts. You know? Wouldn't be I certainly wouldn't put him in my creative department. I mean, seriously, I just don't know whether that, you know, probably because I'm somewhat at ADD myself, I just can't even conceive of that, but I'm not even sure that it's that's. So what? Suppose we have no thoughts. What? How does that benefit us?
The guy that wrote the book Opening the Hand of Thought, which is like a classic Japanese Zen book, Uchiyama Roshi, did a lot of commentaries on Dogen, and I remember reading some commentary that he did on something by Dogen, and he starts talking about how the heart pumps blood, and the stomach pumps acid, and the brain pumps thoughts. That's just what it does. That's, you know, it's just going to keep doing that, you know, whether we like it or not. And I thought, oh, that's really freeing. You know, and this is a Japanese guy saying this, so.
I mean, you know, I was making it, you know, sort of a joke, but thoughts are useful and important. You know, I just think we can sort of vilify thoughts, and they can be useful and important. Now, they can also make us crazy, right? But if they're too prolific. But even that, it's about, we can, if we're not drawn into the drama of our thoughts, if we can sort of ride, you know, the waves like a surfer, then even that, even, you know, a lot of thoughts. Okay. Now, that's the thing I try to get, I don't think I do express it well, but I, you know, this idea of doing the breath practice. The thoughts come, let them come. Just don't chase them. Let them come. It's like the waves. You know, try to hold back the waves at the ocean. No, just let the wave come. It splashes. It goes away. Another word comes. It splashes, right? If you try to resist the waves knock you down. And so, yeah, let them come. Let them go.
A long time ago, at one of the retreats at Kanzan, Genpo, you know, this guy was sitting next to Tetsugen, and when after they were done, Tetsugen would, you know, Bernie, whatever, you know, would say, well, you know, I figured this out, I did this, and you know, and then we're going to do this, and we're going to do this, and Genpo's thing was, well, that's great, but I was just sitting here sitting. So, and I think it's an interesting glimpse into, you know, the practices of two people who have had quite an impact on Zen, for good or for ill. So I don't know. You know, I mean, I sometimes sit and I'm building stairs the whole time, and other times it's a little quieter.
Yeah, and we tend to judge that.
I don't want to be an example of anything, but, you know.
Be a bad example. It's okay. Now, we tend to judge that. We set up a hierarchy. What Dan said, we tend to say one is good, one is bad. You know, but is that true? I mean, if we're grieving, if we've just lost a loved one, should we be sitting on the cushion crying our eyes out, or should we be sitting on the cushion, you know, like Ninja Turtles, with our minds completely clear? And Gary, you may be absolutely right that there certainly are many ways of seeing this Dharma and of seeing this practice, and this is the way that I see it, and I don't, not even suggesting that it's the right way, it's just the way that I see it. But I see Zen as pulling us into life, immersing us in life, getting us into what we're living, what we're doing. I mean, that's part of the reason I'm not a monastic. You know, I don't. My goal is not to kind of withdraw. And, you know, and in this day and age, I question that. I mean, not that, you know, there may be places and times and people that should do it, but this world is going to hell in a handbasket. Can we afford to sit on the sidelines? That's been part of my feeling is, no, we can't. We've got to be engaged in the world.
It strikes me that maybe the quiet mind thing is a side effect that, you know, if you're practicing Zen and you're doing it in a monastic setting, after a number of years, you may just really have a quiet mind. And then that gets confused with being the essence of what Zen is, when really, you know, if you're practicing Zen and you're living in the world, you're not going to have a quiet mind, and that's perfect Zen for living in the world.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. You know, and maybe we all see it. If we come to Sesshin, the first couple of days, our mind is going, bing, 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 you know what I mean? And then gradually, by the end of the week, it's like, and then actually it starts getting ready to go. So it starts, you know, it's like, oh, you know, one more day, tomorrow, you know, I'm going to go home and I'm going to, you know. But we can see that progression. So maybe it's true that if you stayed in a monastic environment long enough, it would kind of get down to a, you know, at least a lower level of activity. But I think the other is true, that no matter how long you did that, if you came back into the world, I think it would sort of just like when we finished the Sesshin, you know, a week after you've been to Sesshin, you can't remember that you've been to Sesshin. You know, the first day you get home, you know, whatever particular variety of poop that you have hits the fan, and then, you know, it's gone. So maybe it's just the mind responding naturally. You know, again, this is sort of this natural, flexible idea that it responds to where, you know, when it's quiet, it's quiet. You know, even with the zazen, how many of you notice that, you know, if you're more active, even just a couple of periods, that you're more active, your mind's more active at the beginning of those couple of periods than it may be kind of towards the end, and it quiets. So, you know, I'm not saying that this doesn't quiet the mind somewhat. I'm just really not sure that that's necessarily a desirable outcome. I'm not saying it's an undesirable outcome. I think the looseness of which we hold things, the flexibility, the openness, is far more important. I guess I'll say it that way.
I think you said it perfectly when you said, so what? You know, it's like, if you've got a noisy mind, practice with a noisy mind. If you've got a quiet mind, practice with your quiet mind. Mm-hmm. You know, but practice.
And it's going to change from day to day, too.
Yeah, and I think it also goes to the heart of why do we practice? Do we practice to feel good, or do we practice to change the world? You know, I mean, you know, if we just want to quiet our thoughts, heroin might do that for us. You know, it does. You know, you go and drool on yourself and all that. But I don't see the world benefiting because, you know, of that. So there's almost that kind of, you know, I'm just sort of shooting from the hip here. That can be sort of, you know, if we want this practice to just make us feel really good, it can. We can go to those deep, open spaces, can dwell in that sort of absolute place. It's very attractive. It's very seductive. And as far as I'm concerned, any Zen teacher that catches you doing that should hit you with the stick.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Any?
Any Zen teacher that catches a student dwelling in the nirvanic ether should give him a good whack. And yeah, sometimes we have those places, they come, but there again, we're not supposed to, you know, we're not attached, you know, our practice is not attaching to them. We have a deep opening experience, and everything is, let it come, let it go, same practice.
You know, we have such an appetite, we have such a yearning for an absolute, a prescription, and I'm grateful that Joshu spent the amount of time that he spent on that cushion, the life that he spent for that. You know, and he had an incredible impact on that. On the other hand, I'm grateful for every bodhisattva who has done no sitting or years of it. You know, and it we all need to find our truth and our way. And I guess I like the thrust of what you're talking about. Because we have to even let go of those prescriptive answers. And, you know, I'm not going to be Joshu, and I'm not going to be... It's right here. And... I'm not even sure what that is. I got to let that go.
Yeah, well, something, I do think... Something that Dan said just made me think of it. I mean, on the other hand, I do feel like those guys, you know, I don't know about contemporary, probably contemporary also, but certainly those the people that we encounter, that we study, the Chow Chos, the, you know, Master Ma, on and on and on and on, that devoted their entire lifetime to practice. that devoted every day in the monastic environment. I think their clarity was probably far greater than most of us will ever experience. There, you know, you watch their instantaneous, unobstructed responses in these, you know, various mandos and dialogues and so on. And it's just awe-inspiring. But again, I'm not equating it to the absence of thought, but simply to that completely open, spontaneous awareness, right? You know, and that they cultivated. I often think, you know, those of us who live in the world can't do that to the depth that, you know, there's no way that, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years in a monastery work every day. But we acquire different things. We go out and we get insane drivers triggering our anger, or, you know, I mean, we have different challenges. We have different ways that we can experience this practice. We have loved ones, right? We have families. We have partners. The monastics didn't have that. And because we have those people we love, right? We have pain. We have loss, as well as joy. And we have to work with all of that. It's very different. You know what I mean? And so I tend not to, you know, I explored this question way back when I was a student with Margaret, this kind of idea. I said, you know, I would come in with these koans and I'd be floored. It's like, you know, oh my God, you know, how can any of us get to the place where they were to be so open, to be so... And I think I finally concluded, we won't. But we've got other stuff to work with. And again, what's the point of the practice? Is it to heal the world, or is it to feel good, or to, you know... And if it's to heal the world, then those of us that are trying to maintain some dialectic between practice and ordinary life are doing something very important. You know?
The monks have sacrificed an enormous amount to be where they are and see as clearly as they do. And perhaps we sacrifice just the reverse. We sacrifice that clarity for living in the world as well as we can. But there's always a sacrifice involved, perhaps.
Yeah. I explored that idea talking to Jukin after she left here, because she wanted to be a monk. She didn't like the idea of being a layperson practicing Buddhism. She had this monastic ideal, and she kept talking about renunciation, and that really spurred some things for me. Like, what does renunciation mean? You know, what would home leaving be if you don't actually leave home? And, you know, and I think that, to bring us full circle back to letting go, you know, it's letting go all the time. You know, we renounce in every moment. Some asshole cuts you off and you renounce your anger, you just let it go, you know, and that's a very profound form of home leaving if we think of our home as our habitual egotistic mode of operating in the world.
I think that's it exactly.
So the home that you speak of is our being in the world rather than our Buddha nature or something, you know, like,
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I mean, I think home leaving as leaving our habit patterns, mm-hmm. You know, leaving those places where we're comfortable and...
The familiar.
And just letting go all the time, you know. I don't have to renounce anything in particular.
Yeah. Well, we were talking about that in Al-Anon yesterday, about letting go of the old habits, which have weighed us down, and building the new ones, and how much longer it takes to build the new ones. I mean, how gradual a process it is to build the new ones, and how difficult it is to leave the old ones, to let go of the old ones.
And see, what we're trying to do, I think, is just slightly different from that. We're trying to let go of the old habits and not build any new ones. Okay. So that the habit is the non-habituation, you know?
Right, okay.
Is the... And we fail at that. I mean, we just, you know, we just do. It's a process. It's a practice. It's a, you know, and it is, as they say in AA, we're seeking spiritual progress, not spiritual perfection. You know, we try and we fail. And then we try again, just like the breath practice.